You've heard of BetaShares. You've probably seen the logo on our podcast. You might even be among their 1 million investors. So you can imagine that I'm delighted to say BetaShares is the official ETF partner of the Australian Finance Podcast. With nearly 100 exchange-traded funds, you can go to betashares.com.au and immerse yourself in ETFs and unique insights covering all of the sectors, themes, core and satellite positions you could want. Think cybersecurity through the HACK ETF, robotics and AI with the RBTZ ETF, and uranium with the URNM ETF. The list goes on. To explore the BetaShares ETF range, visit betashares.com.au, read the relevant PDS and TMD on the website, and consider if the fund is right for you. BetaShares Capital Limited is the issuer. Welcome to the Australian Finance Podcast.
I'm Kate Campbell.
And I'm Owen Rask.
And we're here to give you the tools and knowledge to invest both your time and money better.
If you're new, feel free to jump in with our Starter Pack series that aired in early 2022, or our Shares or ETF mini series.
We've got plenty to share with you in today's episode, but if you want to catch us on socials,
head to Rask Australia on Insta and Twitter.
I'm also found at Kate Campbell AUS on Insta.
And I'm Owen Rask AU on Insta.
Just beware of the fake accounts. We'll never DM you about trading strategies or crypto. And if it sounds a bit weird, it's probably not us.
And just one final heads up before we get into the show. This podcast contains general financial information only.
Welcome back to the Australian Finance Podcast. I'm your host, Kate Campbell, and today I'm here with the wonderful Emma Edwards. As a certified financial behaviour specialist, Emma integrates her own personal journey with research-backed tips and tricks to help us understand our relationship with money and, more importantly, improve it. Emma's brand new book, Good With Money, is a game-changing practical guide to the psychology behind your spending habits, revealing how to manage your money without missing out on the things you love. You'll want to get your hands on a copy after today's conversation, trust me. Today, we're going to jump right into what it means to be good with money, something that we hear a lot about, and how we can improve our relationship with money. There's going to be something for everyone, so let's get stuck into the conversation. Emma, thank you so much for joining me in the studio today.
Thanks, Kate. I'm so excited to be back, this time with a book in tow.
Yes, congratulations.
It's like when you bring your baby to work for the first time.
You've got the first copy.
I do, the one copy available.
Yeah. So we have to make sure we look after it today and don't spill any water on it.
Yes, no creasing.
Now, I wanted to start off with a little excerpt from your book. Imagine that tonight, while you were sleeping, a miracle occurred and you woke up able to say that you were good with money. What would be different? How would you notice the change had occurred? How would you feel? How would your life be enriched? Now, Emma, I'm going to throw this conversation over to you. What does being good with money look like to you?
Being good with money to me is the habits, the behaviors, the beliefs, the level of engagement that you have with your finances on an everyday level. And then sort of as a more broader perspective of money that informs that everyday stuff. So we talk a lot about, you know, investing and growing wealth and that sort of like more, not end destination, but that sort of next level on. But it really doesn't matter how much you're earning if you don't know, if you're not inherently good with money, if you don't have those habits, those beliefs, those behaviors, you're automatically locked out of those next steps. Now, there's, you know, myriad factors systemically that lock people out of those next steps. But regardless of those things, if you don't master the things that are in your control, it's always going to be so much harder to reach those next steps. So to me, that is what good with money is. It's that everyday stuff, embodying somebody that actually looks at their finances, knows where their money is going, makes informed decisions rather than passively moving through life with their money and regretting it all later, and not constantly wondering where all their money went.
You're someone that shared a lot about your journey through your podcast and your social media over the years. How has that definition of good with money changed for you over time, maybe where you were 5 to 10 years ago versus where you are now?
I think looking back really far, like 10 years ago, it was always much more elusive, I think. I knew I wasn't good with money, but I didn't really feel like it was something that I could be. There was endless reasons why, you know, it just wasn't my personality. Or sometimes I would even tell myself that I didn't really want to be, and I was just, doesn't matter, I was just going to be fun and spend all my money and doesn't really matter. Or that I didn't earn enough, or I wasn't in the right industry or whatever, which I think are easy things to hide behind when you are in an industry that doesn't pay very much, or when you're very early in your career and you're not earning very much. It's almost a bit easier to see where you can take control if you've sort of started in a role that pays quite well, because you're a bit more abundantly aware. Whereas when you kind of know that you're not earning very much, you're kind of like, well, I don't earn much. Money's difficult. Not a surprise, kind of thing. Whereas I think as I've moved into the space professionally, but also gone on my own journey, I think it's got the definition of good with money has got a little bit more specific and a bit more application to the broader context of life. And I've also, you know, gone down the path of studying financial psychology. So I'm a lot more aware of outside of those, you know, very present factors, like how much you earn and, you know, where your money's going in the moment, sort of a bit more aware of how our past defines how good we are with money or how not good we are with money. And maybe a bit why I had some wacky behaviors that didn't necessarily make sense in theory, but when you step them back, they make perfect sense based on the beliefs that you developed.
Before we jump into the more practical side of getting good with money, what are some of the reasons why the world makes it so hard for us to get good with money? Because that's something you touch on in your book, which is really important to talk about as well.
Yeah, so the whole first section of my book is, it's broken down into five sections. And the first part is called Give Yourself a Break, because I look into sort of the endless reasons why it's actually really hard to be good with money. It's always been hard to be good with money because of the way that we're programmed as human beings, with a relatively new part of our brain that informs long-term decision making, like saving for retirement and stuff. We're actually not built to hoard resources. We're built to use what we have and then go and find more and use what we have and go and find more. But then when you couple that with, you know, the exponential change in the way that we move through the world, in the way that we consume, in the way that we've been conditioned to consume everything at such a rapid pace over and over again, churn and burn, fashion, food, Ubers, like everything is just like immediately right now. And it feeds directly into the animalistic brains that we're working with. And then, you know, crosses over into our emotions and our self-concepts and all that kind of stuff. But really, if you don't feel like you're good with money, it's not really a surprise, unless someone has been hand-holding you and teaching you to be good with money. If you haven't been taught, you're really in the lottery of whether you've got this natural predisposition to do smart things, which, you know, not many of us do. You've either grown up with education or you're a very lucky person that just sort of, you know, started doing the right thing and getting it right. But for most of us, the majority of people, we're kind of battling with programming and conditioning and systems and temptation and then our own sort of personal psychology and emotions that we've experienced throughout life. None of that's conducive to saving money unless somebody's told you otherwise. So that is kind of why I wrote the book, to be that person, to tell you otherwise.
It's interesting how many battles we have to have with ourselves just to put ourselves in a better financial position, because it's hard to think 40 years ahead for our superannuation, our retirement. It's hard to think about buying a house in 5 years' time and all the sacrifices we have to make today. We're just in constant battle with our brain. And what are some of the steps that if we want to start going, well, I've typically thought of myself as someone who's not good with money, or people have told me, oh, I spend a lot, I'm not good at money, I can't save, I can't buy a house. How can I start to change that and go, I'm not good with money, but I can get better?
Yeah, and it's interesting that you touch on that if somebody else has said. And this is partly why I settled on the title Good With Money, because it's such a, you know, very basic descriptor that people might use about people, you know, oh, she's been good with money, or she's pretty good with money, or, you know, Renee's pretty good with their money. But often it's used for people when they're often in siblings, comparing two siblings, you know, oh, Josh was very good with money, but Jane wasn't, you
know. She's not the money one.
Yeah. So I think if you feel like you're not good with money, or anybody's ever told you that you're not good with money, firstly, give yourself a break. It is completely changeable and you can learn to change these beliefs and behaviors and habits and get to a different outcome. The first thing that I always recommend that people do is just focus on awareness. We often think we have to change everything all at once. And I used to do this. I would sit on the edge of my bed and think, oh my God, I spent all my money last night on a night out. Like, what the hell? And scribble down like a knee-jerk budget where I'm like, okay, I'm not spending any money for the rest of the month. Yeah, every single time.
I feel like I've been there too.
Yeah. And often even doing that when you are earning that low salary, you crunch the numbers and you kind of go, you're almost disenfranchised with it, because you go, oh, well, there isn't that much there. So I can't, you know, course correct at the rate that my brain wants me to at the moment to absolve this anxiety. I always used to go, right, that's it. I'm saving £10,000. because I was in the UK, and it would have taken, that was like a third of my income. No, not yet. That was in dollars. That was like half of my income. So it's, you know, that would have taken a really long time when you're paying rent and stuff like that. So often when you try and rapidly course correct by doing everything and kind of working with that outcome only, it can be really overwhelming and make you feel pretty bad about yourself. So instead, don't do anything yet. Just focus on awareness. What is in your bank account and where is your money going? Look a month, 2 months, 3 months, if you want to be like really onto it. Look at where your money is going and just see. The answers are there. Just see what's happening. It might surprise you. Some things you will know. Some things might be lower than you expected. Some things might be higher than you expected. And what I suggest that people do is sort of go back through those transactions. I call this the snowball spending method. Go through those transactions and categorize things into, obviously, there's your essentials, there's your rent, there's your bills. And then where's the other money going? Categorize that. How much is food? How much is discretionaries? How much can you actually not even remember? How many are you Googling the merchant being like, what the hell was that for $75.95?
Something weird I bought when I saw it on Instagram.
Yeah. TikTok shop. What? What's that? And with the so total those things up, and with the total that is negotiable things, so obviously your rent, you've got to keep paying that, but with any money that you didn't have to spend, total that up and say it's $200. Consider that your opportunity number, and then next month just pay attention to where you're making spending decisions, where you're putting your money, and making a few tiny changes and seeing if you can do better than that $200. Mm-hmm. If you can do something else with that, whether it's spend it on something else because you're actually trying to repair that flat tire and you're thinking, I haven't got any money, or whether you're able to put it into savings straight away or pay off debt, just try and do something. You know that money's there. And I think often when people start looking at their finances, they'll add something up, or, you know, I help a lot of people free up money in their wardrobes because women are so conditioned to buy clothing. And often people go, oh my God, I've spent $5,000 on clothes last year. I can't believe this. I'm so ashamed of myself. And I go, no. That's an opportunity. Mm. If you found that you've been spending $10,000 buying lunch every day or something like that, don't feel bad. That's exciting. What great news. You can free up 10 grand. So it's really win-win. You either go in and you go, I'm actually doing better than I thought. Or you go in and you go, there's all my money. How exciting. I can free up $5,000 here. Like, what can I do with that? How exciting. And then when we see those big numbers, we can sort of think a bit more big picture and have a bit more of a vision of what we're trading this sacrifice for in the moment. And that's how you start to get the progress. Mm. But with the snowball method, you're just breaking it down. You're not making big plans that you're going to stick to for a year. We're just working month by month. What's the opportunity this month? What's the opportunity this month? Can I do better? Can I do better? And then you can start to get a bit more engaged, and you have that level of engagement that means that you can take on a budget or a spending plan or whatever it is that is a bit more proactive.
I like that idea of reframing it to the opportunity. Mm. So because a lot of people don't want to look through their spending because they might feel ashamed or guilty or just embarrassed about where they've spent their money on, because, I mean, most of us don't want to look at our bank statements over the last 3 months. Like, money's just gone everywhere. So, but I think looking at it as an opportunity and going, well, hey, I might have spent $500 on this, but this is $500 I've got to play with over the next month or whatever it looks like.
Mm. It's, you actually want to find those things, because if you're finding that it's negotiable stuff that you're spending the money on, or it's like a habit, or it's a fee that you didn't even know you were paying, or a subscription you're not even using, that's magic. Great. There's the money. You can have it. It's right there for you with just like a tiny habit change. I sort of often say those things that you didn't really want or that weren't really bringing you any enjoyment, you know, you kind of go back and go, why did I buy that? They're the best kind, because I call that low sacrifice, high impact savings. Because yes, there's an element of getting good with money that sometimes, depending on your financial capacity, requires giving up something that in theory you enjoy, whether it's, you know, beauty treatments or sports memberships or whatever. If we're really down to that, why there may need to be sacrifice. But there's usually some spending that's pretty low sacrifice because you didn't even know you were spending it, or you didn't really want to spend it anyway. Mm. So like, start there and take out that spending and free up that money that's really not that restrictive to you at all. And then that kind of empowers you to snowball that progress going forward.
Yeah. If someone has done this and is aware of where they're spending money, do you have any sort of way to look at it a step further and go, well, do I want to spend money on this area?
Yes. So one of my kind of most I don't want to say unique because, you know, nothing's unique, but one of my sort of very special areas of interest when it comes to finances is optimizing where our money is going rather than just essential and non-essential, because that's sort of the first level where we've said, you know, yeah. where is the opportunity?
Rent versus sports memberships.
Yeah. But we can also then look at reviewing our transactions from a values perspective, from a joy perspective. So when you're doing that monthly review looking back, you can rank each transaction out of 5 or out of 10, or even categorize it into a certain sort of, use category. And then look at prioritization. Like, at every level of wealth, you have to prioritize something. We might be prioritizing, festivals and tickets and books and things over eating out, like which is more important to me at this time in my life. Even if you're a millionaire, you're probably prioritizing yachts versus private jets. Like, you always have to, must be nice, but there's always a level of prioritization. So that's the best thing you can teach yourself. And in order to prioritize, yeah, you can take a cookie cutter approach from some white guy like Dave Ramsey and be like, oh, well, I shouldn't be eating out. But if you're getting value from that, more so than you're getting value from discretionary shopping or whatever, cut that out first so that you can free up for your highest priority. And then as your financial capacity changes, or if you come into any other money through any other means, you know, bonus, gift, inheritance, whatever, you're more in touch with where your money is working for you. Same as when you get a pay rise, it's how we always talk about that lifestyle inflation, lifestyle creep type thing. When you actually know what your priorities are, you can deploy your money in the best way. And it doesn't rely on you not ever spending money. It's just optimizing where you're spending money to get the most value for it in a way that's personal to you.
And that's the trap, isn't it? Because so much of the media and marketing nowadays says that we should have all of this immediately. It doesn't add any sense of priority to your life. It just makes everything seem important. Yep. And in your book, you wrote about some of the different ways that companies sort of trap you in that spending pattern with, oh, there's only one of these left, or the discount ends tomorrow at midnight, and all those different patterns that they trap us into spending money immediately because we don't have time to really think about what we want.
Yeah, I say it several times in the book, I think, like, our priorities have been hijacked very gradually, particularly for women. You know, we are told that the way we look is more important than how much is in our bank account. And no wonder that that's the foundation of a lot of people's spending habits, because that's what we've been told is important, how much we weigh and what we look like. We haven't been told to worry about retirement until very recently. And even if we do have the wherewithal to go, I'm not going to worry about that. I'm going to worry about my retirement, or focus on my retirement, I should say. We're still competing with societal standards that to some degree we have to play ball in. It's a privilege to withdraw from them, really. I'm not going to wear makeup. Well, if you're trying to get a job in a certain industry, if you work in fashion, you can't really just withdraw from makeup unless you're naturally radiant. Do you know what I mean? There's so much societal pressure as well. And we have to, you know, that's a, you know, the big unanswerable question, I suppose, because we can't all just withdraw necessarily because there's financial implications to that.
Yeah. There's a certain cost to just showing up to life.
Yeah. But thinking about where, for you personally, the degree to which you want to be involved in that, the degree to which you get any enjoyment from that, because there is a line. Some of it's conditioning and there is enjoyment to be had from, you know, commercialized self-care. I love a bubble bath just as much as anybody else, you know, spa, you know, there is enjoyment to be had from those things. And really, the enjoyment of almost anything is conditioning, aside from like quality time with other human beings. Most of the commercialized stuff that we do is dictated to us somehow. But it's bringing it back to you, and where is $10, $50, $100 best spent to you? To some people, it might be like a festival ticket. Honestly, I'd rather die. But I'll spend more on hotels than a lot of people at my income level would, because I'll cut other things out to afford that, because that's what I want.
I remember you telling me you love checking out new hotels.
I love
hotels. It seemed
hotels.
Like such an odd thing. I'd never heard anyone talk about that.
I love it.
I want to get the newest book. You want to check out the newest hotel.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, yours is a cheaper vice than mine.
Looking holistically, how has getting good with money for you filtered into other aspects of your life? Because I know that we often think about money as a separate thing, but it is so interlinked with our career, our relationship, our goals.
It's a really interesting point. And yeah, I think it's funny that money's been coming into like the cultural zeitgeist for the last few years, but it's always been sort of on the outer somehow. I wonder why. But I think it's interesting because it does translate to so many other areas of your life. When you're engaged and you're disciplined and you're focused on doing the right thing for your finances, not necessarily obsessively, depending on the way that your brain works, you might have periods of greater focus than others. Put your foot on the gas, take your foot off the gas, depending on what your goals are and what's happening in your life. But I think that when you, I guess, are connected to the consequences of your behavior in a financial sense, it also connects you to the consequences of your behavior and your decisions in every other area of life. You can see things, you know, you can see numbers in your bank account compounding, you can see your behavior compounding, you can see your choices compounding. And I don't know, this is a sweeping statement, and I'd love to see if there's any research on this, but I don't feel like people are rocking around being really, really diligent with their finances and a total hot mess in every other area. Mm. I feel like it's that progressive, like, as I've got better with money, with my business, with, like, just, I guess, my work in general, your, and, you know, money and career obviously crosses over. You're more engaged with how much you're earning and what your worth is and that kind of thing. But I mean, I've also barely drink anymore. Okay, I'm over 30, so maybe that would have happened anyway. But also, I don't know, a lot of my friends with kids like a drink. You know, I don't drink anymore. I'm back at the gym, but not in like a diet culture-y way. Like, it's not this sort of life overhaul, but I think the act of changing a habit and mastering something and experiencing the positive outcome in any sense can cross-pollinate into other areas of your life if you've got other goals that you're working on.
Yeah, because even just working out, well, what are my values and what are my priorities and what do I like spending money on will probably filter everywhere else, because you're going to go, well, this is where I want to work. This is the kind of people I want to be with. Like, all of that, understanding yourself better, because a lot of what you talk about in your book and what we talk about on the podcast is just getting to know who you are a bit better, so you can start making choices that are for you, not just for everybody else. And so that directly relates with money and relates to everything else.
Yeah, I think it sort of gets you into big picture thinking as well. Like, and again, you never know how much of it would have come with age anyway, but I definitely was very not super peripherally aware about myself or anyone else, really, about the longer term future or what I want and what I don't want. I was always very passive. Again, I think it can come from your upbringing a lot. Some people are very empowered to be very in the driver's seat of their life. I just wasn't really. I've kind of watched my mum get a really unlucky hand at life, and I just kind of thought, well, that was bad luck. Like, what can I do about it? But while there is bad luck, it's like with everything, while there is bad luck, you can either try and get good luck or you can just do nothing and hope, you know, get dealt something, you know. I think it's made me just more aware of my participation in my life, because you can't just let it wash over you.
Yeah.
It's really easy to do that, and money too. And some people can coast by with that because, you know, they don't get bad luck or whatever. And some people, I actually spoke to, I did a talk for some cancer nurses recently, about a year ago now. And a lot of them said that people have a lot of regrets about money when they're on their last sort of phase of life, which I thought was really interesting, because we've heard about, you know, that book called The Top Five Regrets of the Dying and stuff like that. And I referenced that because I knew that would kind of engage them in what I was saying. But they said that money does come up often, and especially in that sort of generation now that they would be caring for at that older age, people that would have pursued it at the cost of other things, or prioritized it over other things, or used it in all the wrong areas, or, you know, thought about accumulating so much of it and then not ever seeing the benefit of that, or not really knowing why, or yeah, I just think it's really interesting.
That is fascinating. And something else I'd be keen to talk about more, for a lot of people, money seems like a really tedious, dry topic, and a lot of people have a lot of resistance when it comes to getting involved in their finances and taking a more active seat in the direction of their own financial journey. How would you suggest someone approach their finances if they've been the one that's like, oh, I don't really want to sort my finances out, or it's something I can sort out later?
I think money can be really fun, and I think that the easiest way to get into it is to make it fun. And for me, I feel like this is often to do with knowing your motivation style or the way your brain works. Like, are you very motivated by rewards? Is it going to take, you know, things like challenges get a really bad rap. I know that people are doing variations of 75 hard and 75 rich and stuff like that on TikTok and things like
I've
that.
I've seen that.
And there's
the
75 hard
sounds really hard.
I'm not interested in that.
Two workouts a day, Emma.
No. I'm not into that at all. But I like the, you know, 75 richer, 75 yeah. hard style, I think is one where you don't buy clothes and you put together outfits from your existing wardrobe.
I mean, you can create any kind of challenge you want.
Anything
you
want, yeah. Two broke chicks are doing a 75 rich in life or something like that they're doing. Anyway, challenges get a really bad rap, especially if they're no spend challenges or if there's any kind of restrictive aspect to it. But if it makes it fun, go nuts. Like, if gamification works for you, do that. If community accountability works for you, get a friend or join one of these TikTok challenges or join another kind of container where you're going to be involved. If there's resistance to getting involved with it, you need to use some other pillar of motivational theory, I suppose, to get you engaged. So there's got to be something that's interesting to you. There's got to be a desire there. Build up on those things. There's got to be a commitment there. There's got to be a need for you to want to change. So dial up those things in some kind of way. Make it interesting. Make it fun. It's almost like I feel like I'm reciting James Clear's Atomic Habits. Like, yeah. It makes a lot of sense. Like, make it easy. Make it enjoyable to do. Give yourself a container to try something out. If you're externally motivated by rewards, put a reward at the end of that. There's a lot of research around how visualization can help you get engaged with things. So if you're like, oh, I really don't want to engage in changing my spending habits or sorting my money out or even looking at my bank account, how can you like bribe yourself to do that? Like, how can you visualize something that you want that you can't have because of this problem and kind of get your brain to trade off the energy? Like, if I put a bit of energy here, then I can get this thing that I've been thinking about, whether it is, you know, a holiday or a pair of sneakers or a debt payment that you make, like whatever it is, something to reward yourself for doing the hard thing, because we should treat ourselves like children sometimes.
Sometimes you just have to be a parent to yourself.
Exactly.
There's so much power in accountability though, and having someone to do it with, whether it's you can just listen to a podcast and that encourages you, or whether you can find a group of people working on their finances together where you can go, well, we might not be able to find the answers on our own, but collectively we can all do a bit of research and come to the table and share our progress, share when we didn't reach our goal for the month and what went wrong and maybe how can we adjust it or make it more realistic for the next month. I remember chatting to some people on our roadshow who were forming little groups together to work on their finances, and that's just so encouraging because it can feel like we're doing this all alone.
Yeah, it really can, especially if you're in a community where, you know, you're the only one that's needing to focus on this. Maybe everybody else has already done this, or they're just naturally really good with money, or if you're working at a different capacity level than other people. You know, it can be really confronting to like all do a finance challenge and everyone else is saving at a much faster rate than you. Like, finding other people that are working with the same variables as you. That's why I think it's really important to talk about this stuff in the workplace, because you're more likely to have peers around you that are in a much more similar situation to you. You know, the people that work with you in your like line of work, or under the same manager or whatever, like you're probably going to be on very similar salary. So you're working with the same like routines and circumstances. So I think that can be really fun as well. You know, you do the same thing with fitness. Like, you might go for a after work Pilates class with a friend from work, like get a after work money chat at happy hour.
I think most people would want to do that. You just like slowly bring it up.
Yeah, I think that there's this weird taboo, particularly with the younger, not so much the younger generation, but when you are younger in any generation, that if you're the one that like brings up wanting to save money, you're boring. But I think it's like rebranding it and being like, this is what cool people do. This, like, but getting good with money is cool.
This is how we're going to afford that holiday.
Yeah. And there's the thing, like, making it something bigger. Like, no one wants to be like the killjoy that's like, sorry guys, can't come for dinner tonight. But if you get people involved on a much bigger level and be like, actually, I just went through my transactions and we spent like $400 on going out last month. If we don't do that for 3 months, we can go to Europe in summer. I mean, you know, that's 2016 prices, but you know what I mean. Like,
but most people, like good people in your life, want you to succeed. Yeah. So if you get them involved, and if you're like, I really want to save $5,000 over the next 2 years because I want to go on this adventure. If you get them involved and they'll understand and they'll support you, and maybe you just do a dinner at home instead of going out, and then they can sort of support you during the saving up process and also be excited when you go on the trip because they've been part of the journey.
Yeah. I think it can just sometimes be a clash, particularly in like friendship circles, if your desire to make a positive change is confronting to somebody that is not ready to change. Like in the trans-theoretical model of behavior change, you look at people's readiness to change, and people will not change until they are ready. And there's a big period of time beforehand where they're not ready to change. And so they'll actually be very resistant to the change. So I think if you're, you know, it assumes that you all need some sort of change, but say, you know, you're all being young and fun and not managing your money, and eventually you all want to get better at it. I think that's the only time it can cause, that's an important time it can cause friction, because if you are more ready for change than someone else. But I mean, yeah, you choose who you share your information with, I suppose. And yeah, if people don't want the best for you, then maybe that's a red flag. I don't know.
Yeah. And that could be the time where it's slowly, you want to add a few more people to your friendship group that are maybe more interested in this particular direction you want to head in.
Yeah.
Like if you want to get fit, if you start being friends and going to running group and doing all that sort of stuff, it makes it a lot easier to get motivated because there's other people that are doing it and walking the walk.
Yeah.
Totally. Or running agree. The run.
I running the run.
That was really bad. All right.
F45.
You mentioned money regrets before, and I was reading an article you wrote last year about your money regrets. Mm. And one of them you talked about, which was quite interesting, was being too generous with money. Now, people don't usually talk about that. Most people are like, they're not a very generous person. Mm. It's rarely you get too generous.
I'd kind of forgotten about this point in my life, but I kind of became aware of it when I was doing a lot of my financial psychology studies and kind of looking back at the key, I guess, financial flashpoints in my life. And something I remember is that I was always the one. So my family had a low income, or my mum was a single mum. I got this like maintenance payment basically from college kind of thing when you're like 17, 18. It's meant to be for like the cost of books, but books don't cost that much. It was like £20 or £30 a week, which is quite good.
Yeah.
What I didn't really get about life, though, was that while other people's parents who weren't eligible for it weren't literally giving them the £20 a week to spend at the local shop on food for everyone, their parents had the capacity to buy them things like textbooks or to buy them things like driving lessons or those other things. So I think that I should have probably been using it for things like that. But I was always like, well, I've got more, because I also worked. So I was like, well, I've got more disposable income than you guys. So like, I'll shout everybody the round of potato wedges. And nobody really said it. I mean, of course, you're going to be like, yeah, sweet. Because there was a lot of like friction in school about like who got this payment and who didn't. And all the rich kids whinging about it. Well, rich kids, you know, people that weren't eligible for it were like whinging about it and stuff. I was quite generous, and I always worked a lot of hours. So I had disposable income at that time because, you know, I had my student loan that was covering like by the time I went to uni, I had my student loan that was like covering some of my rent and stuff like that. And I just kept picking up more shifts whenever I wanted more money. And so I would shout things for other people because I was like, well, I physically have money here now. But I wasn't aware of the opportunities that I could get for myself that other people would get naturally because their family might be able to support them. I didn't understand that I could use that money for other things. I was like, well, I have it now, so I'll spend it now. And that definitely
set me back. How did you shift out of that into thinking, well, I want to be a generous person. I want to be able to give money to charity and shout my friends coffee, but I also want to look after my own financial future as well.
In all honesty, I haven't flipped it back to generosity yet. Well, I have in, I guess, a charity sense. I'll often give a lot to like mutual aid funds for Aboriginal communities. There's like a few people that I follow that will post, you know, they're not like official charities, obviously, because they're literally passing the money right on. So I'll do it in that sense. But with friends and stuff, I didn't realize at the time it was a problem in enough time to stop doing it. And then I went into like full-time work where I was on a very low income, so I didn't have really the capacity to do it. And then I moved overseas and I had like different friendship circles and things like that. It's just sort of something I phased out through necessity and also gradually starting to understand how behind I was financially. But it's not something. I was actually writing an article about this the other day about like should friends shout each other dinner and things like that, or if there's a one with a higher income or a lower income, like should that be split in a different way than 50-50? It's a really complex one. I think in the challenges of like the economy that we're in and the work environment that we're in, where like not a lot of people have loads and loads of surplus, I would like to be more generous in that way, but I haven't quite worked out how it coexists yet. But it is something, particularly after writing the article, I would like to do more of, because I feel like we're getting increasingly individualistic when it comes to money. And I think there's more room for, as like our financial capacity grows, I feel like there's more room for giving in a peer-to-peer sense. I think it's very obvious that you want to give to causes and things like that. But it's difficult because some people find it, you know, does it only work if it's reciprocated? Because some people don't want to be shouted something by someone else. But then even that is a bit weird because that's very individualistic to be like, no, I'll make my own way. Like,
it's interesting conversation to have with your friends, isn't it?
I think it's a really interesting conversation, like across the board, even thinking about that, you know, no thank you to the help. I remember when I first moved to Australia, my husband was working at, I won't say the company, but a job where his dad had also, he either did work there or was working there. And I found it really hard to get work because I was on a working holiday visa, couldn't get work anywhere. And he said to me, I can probably get you a job at this place. Looking back, I'm thinking, why didn't you take it? It was good. It was like $26 an hour. It was good money, yeah. Like for, especially coming from the UK when I was earning like $12 an hour. And I was like, no, I don't want the help. Like, I want to do this on my own. Yeah. And it's a very strange, I don't know, it kind of blurs the line of like, no, I'm going to, you know, it's, but it's super individualistic. Like, why shouldn't we help one another on that peer-to-peer level, whether it's shouting them dinner or being generous with your surplus of income, or whether it's like, helping people into a career, because you do it as you get further on in your career. Like if you know somebody that could get you in somewhere you want to work, like obviously you're going to do that. But it's that weird thing when it's like the power imbalance is different. You're like, I don't want that leg up. I want to get there on my own. That like dream of being self-made or whatever. I don't know. So I think it's an interesting conversation of when you're of generosity and when to accept it.
Mm. And what element of community do you want in your life?
How does it work if it's not equal? Like, does the generosity have a function if everybody has the same capacity? But then also if everybody doesn't have the same capacity, when is it inappropriate? Like, when does expectation come into it? Nobody's ever going to go into it going, yeah, I expect you to pay. But if every time you go out with a friend they pay, natural repetition, you're going to be like, oh, they're paying this time. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's a weird one.
Yeah. A different one to think about. I don't think we have answers. But
it's an unanswerable question.
It's an interesting one to explore. And switching gears a little bit, if we're thinking about what we're working towards with our finances this year, and maybe it's being good with money, maybe it's making our first investment, maybe it's making our second investment or getting out of debt, a lot of us think about goals and New Year's resolutions, end of December, start of January. I mean, you can do them at any point in the year. What are some ideas for people based off all your research you've done that want to work on their finances in some capacity this year?
Well, I'll actually share something that I'm personally doing this year as well. I have made a promise to myself to do a proper, strategic, multifaceted monthly check-in. So, I'm being self-employed, I'm regularly checking in with like my finances and I kind of know what's going on. And I'll do like a big review at the end of the year, but I'm trying to do in various different elements, much more of a monthly like reset. And then what is the focus for the new year based on where I'm at? Like, for example, we're at the end of Jan. I've spent the first 2 weeks sick, exactly the same as last year, which is really annoying. But it's already tempting to be like, oh, well, I'm behind on those goals now. Mm. But actually, if we flip that into be like, well, that's just what's going into this review. And then how am I going to adjust those for Feb and for March and onwards? Because I think the first 3-4 months of the year, you're still pretty compass in terms of what you promised to do at the start of the year. By August, you're like, I don't even remember.
It's a whole
to be
new,
honest.
Yeah. New year by that point.
Especially if you end up having like a bit of a tumultuous year. It's so easy to just throw it out the window. Whereas if you make that commitment to yourself to continuously check in and then tweak and redeploy, whether it's in literally a financial sense or in a goal sense or whatever, I'm really trying to do that because especially being self-employed where I've also got to think about where I earn money. I'll go into the year being like, yeah, you know, this is the year that I'm going to do this. And then I might have a couple of bad months and kind of go, oh. And suddenly that drive has dried up. Whereas it's almost like you need to sort of refill the cup at the start of every month. And so that you can have, like, everybody knows that buzzy feeling in January.
Yeah, you've got a lot of energy because you've just had 2 weeks off. You think you can do anything.
And your brain's got that clean break that you're seeing the year, like romanticizing this year you're going to have, and you're like picturing the TikTok you're going to make at the end and all this stuff. You can just see it now, the end of year achievements. But it's just natural for that to dry up. Whereas if you make a conscious choice to keep, to carry that cup of water, that cup of motivation all the way through and punctuate it monthly instead, or even quarterly, but even that's quite a long time, I think it helps you stay the course for something that, you know, majority of us will get thrown off course by something or other, whether it's getting a cold for 2 weeks or it's something much bigger than that.
So for you, if you set yourself a financial goal, you'd be setting the big thing you want to achieve at the start of the year, but then every month you're thinking about, well, what am I going to do for the next 30 days to work towards that? Is that how you approach it?
Sort of, though I won't do, because I don't have a static income, I won't do a big outcome-based goal. I've tried it before with income-based goals, but in business, it's kind of, you know, you can make the income, but if the profit's not there, it's irrelevant. I also find they're a bit too big for me, and it's not always clear, especially when you've got to be a bit sort of serendipitous with what's happening. I will more do sort of like much bigger thematic goals, or have like a word. So my word this year is mastery in various, I know how that kind of works in various areas of my life and my business. So at the monthly check-in, I'm sort of like looking at these areas and thinking, okay, you know, what areas of mastery have been achieved here? What have I done to try and get closer to that? What are the different circumstances? And then deploy that into the next month. And with an income or a savings goal, for example, it's much more around, okay, so what I'm trying to get myself better at, like cause and effect. So like, what did I make that month? Okay, well, what did I do? Because it's not, I don't know, I think it's a difficult thing when you do like a multi-hyphenate type of job where your income is coming from different areas, which at times can be really abundant and then at other times can be really scarce. Sort of trying to pattern recognition and seeing how pulling different levers can get me kind of like working smarter rather than working harder. When I had a big outcome-based goal, I would just constantly keep like trying and trying and trying, whereas choosing to master something instead and actually not only get the outcome but work out how I got to the outcome so that I can replicate it in like an sort of an employee or a much more everyday sense where that income is guaranteed. I would sort of, this is almost where the snowball spending comes in, because you can actually look at, okay, I saved heaps that month. What did I do? I found it really easy this month. What's the data there? How can I deploy that into the next month? So it's much more of like a commitment to being able to replicate your success rather than going balls to the wall and saving $5,000 and then going, well, now what? Because that can happen.
Yeah.
You actually know how you did that, why you did that, and now you can save 10 or 20.
What about picking yourself up after setbacks? Because a lot of us will go, oh, we want to save $1,000 this month, and then life happens and that unexpected rojo comes through and suddenly we didn't progress towards our goal at all this month. Maybe we went backwards and it feels like, oh, is there any point still sticking with it, because I'm not going to hit that goal I set.
I actually have a section in the book about financial resilience, which I will find for you. Obviously, I talk about having the practical resilience in terms of having money for emergencies, but there's also an element of mental resilience, which comes from the field of financial psychology. So it talks a lot about the concept of learned optimism and how, without dancing towards toxic positivity, how learned optimism can help you come back from those setbacks. And it talks about these three P's: permanence, pervasiveness, and personalization. So permanence refers to the duration we associate with an incident of adversity. Pervasiveness refers to the way we ascribe either specific or universal effects and meanings to such an incident. And then personalization refers to our attribution of cause or blame for the incident, either to internal or external factors. So the thinking is, if you can think of those three P's, when you try and save $1,000, you're, you know, denied a pay rise and you get your rego and also you got a flat tire and a parking ticket. When we think of those three P's, how much am I blaming myself for this? How universal or specific am I making this? Am I making this mean something about all of my savings capacity going forward? Am I making this mean something about myself going forward? And also, how permanent is this? Like, those are actually isolated events. They have no bearing on your future financial outcomes, but they do have a bearing on you. So if they get to you, your behavior is going to be less conducive to the financial outcomes you want, because you're making them a much more permanent issue. Whereas when you can actually get used to, a lot of it's around the language and, you know, that you, it's not about not being frustrated by those things, but it's about recognizing when you're saying things like, oh, well, I've just stuffed it now, or I'll just start again next month, or I can't do it then, or it's just so hard. And these are things that I, especially being self-employed, I catch myself with often. I'll have like a sponsored campaign lined up and it will get cancelled, and suddenly I'm making grand claims about how my industry is dead. And there's that pervasiveness thing and the permanence. Like, it's not, that's not what it's about. It's almost about stepping back and seeing those incidences being thrown off course for what they are, and not making them mean something else that not only makes you feel worse, but actually informs your behaviour. That's going to be the that's going to be the thing that throws you off. If you get a flat tire, it bears no implication on what you're going to do next month, unless you tell yourself that it means that you can't save any money. Then you're going to go out and spend all your money right up to that capacity, because that's what you believe to be true.
It's so easy to extrapolate one failure or mistake and say, well, if I failed that, I must just be a failure at all of this related stuff, even though it has nothing to do with each thing.
And it's what your brain wants to do at that time, to absolve that anxiety and to feel like you're in control. You're trying to make sense of the situation, and the easiest thing to do is to just apply that universal rule of, that's the way it is and this is how I understand it, and now I can move on. Whereas if you think of those three P's and maybe read the whole chapter rather than just those three things, but thinking about how you're viewing the situation and how it might be informing future behavior.
And if you're listening to this now and you've already fallen behind one of the goals you set, do not wait till the 1st of January 2025. Use this month. You can choose any day this week to just reset and focus on what you're going to achieve from this point on.
Yes. Everyone know that the year starts in March anyway.
I mean, January's just flown past, Emma.
Yeah, truly.
I don't know where it's gone. Now, there is so much good stuff in Good With Money. It is a wonderful book. I hope everyone picks up a copy. It's a great one to give to a friend who's at the start of their own finance journey too. And it doesn't overlap with many of the other finance books you've read. So I think that'll be a good addition to the bookshelf. But Emma, what's the number one thing you want listeners to take away from this conversation?
The number one thing I want people to take away from this conversation is, it doesn't need to be as hard as your brain might want you to think that it does. Whether it's taking small action, or it's moving on from that adversity a little bit faster, or even just changing the way that you're viewing that adversity, remember that your brain is actually against you a lot of the time, and it takes time to master its habits in order to actually change your own outcomes.
You're not born being good with money. It's something you work on day by day. Emma, if people want to get in touch with you, if they want to grab a copy of Good With Money, where should they go?
You can go to any major bookstore, Dimmicks, Readings, Big W, etc. You can find me on Instagram at the.brokegeneration, also very occasionally on TikTok under the same handle, or head to thebrokegeneration.com, or listen to the podcast, The Broke Generation Podcast.
Yeah, and if you want some inspo on setting some goals this year, if you haven't yet and it's something you want to do, many listeners, when I put a poll up on socials the other day, indicated they still wanted to set some goals this year. You have a lot of inspiration on your podcast. So Emma, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you for having me, Kate.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Australian Finance Podcast. We hope you learned something new and were able to take one thing away from this episode.
If you're keen to learn more, head on over to RASC Education and take one of our free money and investing courses. You could even become a RASC Core member for less than your Netflix subscription each month. And don't forget to subscribe for new episodes in your inbox every week.
Plus, if you enjoyed the show, we'd love you to leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, and send any questions our way via the link in the description. And before we go on, did this podcast contain personal financial advice just for me?
Absolutely not, Kate. Our podcast actually contains general financial information only. What that means is the information does not take into account your financial needs, goals, objectives, or even your situation. So because of that, it's important that you consider if the information is appropriate to you and your needs before acting on it.
If that all sounds a bit confusing, or you're still working out what your needs are, it's a great idea to consult a licensed and trusted financial planner. And don't forget to do your own research.
InvestSmart's portfolios are turning 10, and to celebrate, 10 InvestSmart boot camps are up for grabs. This self-paced online course is ideal for both seasoned investors and those who are just starting out. Valued at $99, you could win a spot on this highly rated course. To enter the competition and for terms and conditions, simply visit InvestSmart.com. www.investmentpodcast.com.au/win. Don't miss out on this chance to learn from experts and take your investing to the next level. Simply visit investsmart.com.au/win. Good luck. Thanks for listening to this podcast. Before you go, I wanted to share some things with you. Specifically, I wanted to tell you about the 10 ways that Rask could help you in 2024. As many of you know, Rask has grown to become one of the biggest investing and finance platforms in Australia. Across our podcasts, our websites, our memberships, and so on, we now engage around 200,000 Aussies, which, considering we started in a humble lounge room on a Kmart desk, one of those old fake white wooden ones, I'm pretty ecstatic about where we are 6 years later. As part of becoming one of Australia's biggest platforms for wealth creation and preservation, we now have a very special position in the country in that we can bring you some of the best, most thoughtful, expert-driven ways to protect and grow your wealth. And I'm going to share some of those with you now. I've got 10 ways that we can potentially help you or match you with someone who can. The first thing that I want to tell you about is the biggest step we've ever taken at Rask, which is the launch of our Rask Invest platform. This is a platform that lets our team, led by me, invest for you, primarily through low-cost, diversified ETFs. We'll have three strategies at launch, and every investor who comes through can pick one of the three strategies, being a balanced strategy, a growth strategy, and a high-growth strategy. The balanced strategy focuses on passive income, and the high-growth strategy focuses on longer-term compounding. You will find a link in your podcast player to register your interest. We will be taking off soon. Number two, if you prefer to DIY your investing, you can join me and over 4,000 members inside Rask Core. That's our full ETF and ASX share research membership community. You can join now and you'll get updated ETF portfolio recommendations every quarter, as well as ongoing ASX and global stock research. Every single month, we call them the All-Star Stocks. You get that alongside the ETF portfolios, as well as other members-only content. It's called Rask Core. Number three, our first ever partnership with a business other than our own was a business by the name of Blusk, which has since become Flint Group. Flint Group is led by Chris Bates and Christian Stevens, two of Australia's most highly regarded mortgage brokers. Already over 200 Rask community members have begun the Rask plus Flint Group mortgage broking process. You can click the link in your podcast player if you're refinancing, investing, a first home buyer, or whatever. You've probably heard Chris on the show many times. Number four, you can connect with our most trusted financial advisors. Whether you're 25 years old, just graduated uni, and looking to set yourself up, or approaching or in retirement and you've got that nest egg you want to protect and generate a passive income from, you can get in contact with our trusted panel of financial advisors. You can find the link in your podcast player. It's there each and every week. Just click the thing that says financial planning. Number five, if you want specialist insurance advice, as Warren Buffett said, rule number one is don't lose money. And rule number two is don't forget rule number one. Insurance is vitally important, especially when it comes to your number one asset, you. Whether you're a single income household or a couple, and you just want to protect what would happen if. You want to protect your family if something goes wrong. You want to protect your spouse if you lose your job. You want to protect yourself if you hurt yourself on the weekend at footy. Insurance is a way to do that. And I think the best way to do insurance is through a financial planner. And there's a few reasons for that, but one of them is sometimes some insurers will only work with financial advisors, but they can also be your companion as you go through the sometimes daunting process of getting insurance done properly. Sometimes you might not even know, but you're not even covered, even though you think you are. So get the right advice. You'll find a link in the show notes to check that out. Number six, buying property. If you're like me and you're thinking of buying property in the next 12 months, or maybe you've already invested and you're looking to downsize, getting the right advice and being able to build wealth through property is a proven strategy. It might be one of the most contentious, But I think that we have one of Australia's best property coaches in our ranks. That is Pete Wargent. Pete is the host of the now super popular Australian Property Podcast by Rask. And he's also my analyst team's macro consultant. So if you're a member of RaskCore, you will have seen Pete's name around the traps. He's a property coach and buyer's agent, and he works with a select number of people each and every year. Just a note on this. This is not a commercial thing with Pete. Pete just has great services, so we offer them to the community. And when he fills up, he fills up. You can find out more about Pete's coaching in the show notes. Next up, tracking your portfolio for tax? I think you are, because I think you have to. So we've partnered with Nevexa to help you manage your share and ETF reporting, whether it's tax or performance. All RASK users get 20% off an annual plan with Nevexa. You can sync your portfolio with Nevexa's software, and it automatically tracks your dividends, your capital gains tax, and more. Again, not a commercial partnership. We don't make anything from working with Nevexa, but they do create some great tools which the RASK community uses each and every day. Number 8. Want to run your own business? Maybe you already do. If you want more profit, but less stress, less time consumed, and less energy lost, get in contact. We have a partner business called Inflection. The Inflection Accelerator Program is a complete online course that helps you and a community of members engage and follow a proven strategy for growing your business. I'm grateful to be one of the coaches inside the Accelerator program, helping business owners right across Australia. You can find more following the link in your podcast player. It's the one that says coaching. Number 9, if you haven't already checked it out, join over 20,000 other people who tune into the RASK YouTube channel. It is completely free, and you get notified when we go live and when we publish podcast episodes. There is a podcast on the RASK network each and every day, as well as bite-sized material that's less than 60 seconds, or those really punchy tutorials and webinars that are just 15 minutes that take you through a really exciting topic, whether it's how to buy a property, whether it's how to pick a dividend ETF. Some of our most popular content actually just explains things like, what the heck is franking credits and how do I calculate if I've got some? That's on our YouTube channel. Number 10, if you want to be a better investor, a saver, a better partner with money, or just understand your own relationship with money, you can do that. All of that by going to the RASK Education website and taking a free course. We've enrolled over 26,000 students at the time of this recording, and we are on a mission to get to 100,000 in the next few years. RASK Education is our mostly free education platform, covering everything from budgeting and automation to the probably, I would say, the best value investing program in the country. So whether you're a value investor, an intermediate investor, you want to know how to value Woolworths shares, or you simply just want to understand what ethical investing is, or buy your first property and what actually happens on settlement day, head to the RASK Education website and enroll in something today. It is free and it supports us, because then I can come on here next month and I can say we've got 27,000, and hopefully we reach critical mass where we can help more Australians manage their money better. Thank you for listening to this long-winded ad. If you want to get in contact with me, you know where to go. There's a link in your show notes. Basically, these 10 services, even though some of them we don't make any money from, support RASK and allow us to produce these podcasts, attract the biggest and best guests from Australia and around the world, and bring them to you to answer your questions. Thank you for being part of the RASK network, and thank you for your ongoing support. Bye for now.